Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Brendan Joel Kelly of the Anchorage Press, and Tony Hall of Alaska Newspapers. Steve, there is no joy in Mudville.
Nope.
The mighty gas line has struck out, to pursue a metaphor. BP and ConocoPhillips have closed down their Denali pipeline proposal. Mm-hmm. What happened? What happens next?
Well, you know, we have all been waiting anxiously for the results of the open season to see what the prospective pipeline builders could come up with for customers who would want to ship their gas down a proposed pipeline. Well, BP, ConocoPhillips, the Denali Group announced this week that they really couldn't drum up enough customers to make this project financially viable, so they pulled out. They spent over $150 million.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, I think it was more like $160, $168 is what I want to say, but yeah, a lot of money. And they say they just couldn't make it work. Now, as far as what happens next, we still have to remember there's another organization out there, TransCanada, coupled with Exxon, and they're still in the running. We still don't know what the results of their open season is. They've kind of kept it under wraps. TransCanada has one thing, at least one thing going for it, and that is that they're the preferred, they won the bidding under the AGEA process, and they have that $500 million appropriation or subsidy, if you will, from the state. So they got a little more staying power in this particular game. So we'll see what happens. They remain optimistic that it can make this happen. One of the things that's happened here is some of the naysayers, folks who are against AGEA, are using this information from Denali Group to say, okay, we got to scrap AGEA, we got to do something different. But I think
there'd be a call to build the Tidewater pipeline.
There's also that. There, we had Bill Walker on earlier in the week, and he says now it's time to build a big gas line through the state, sell the gas to Asian markets. So still have to let TransCanada and Exxon play this thing out and see what they come up with, though.
Brendan, is this a project Alaskans can't give up on because they're, well, Alaskans?
Well, Alaskans haven't given up on it for, 40 years now?
About that.
Since Governor Hickel and Bill Walker's continuing his legacy, and we'll see if the governor vetoes it, but isn't there a large chunk of money for an in-state gas line or for studies in the capital budget?
That would be very surprising if he did, given this.
Yeah, keep absolutely. It seems like that's a pretty smart decision not to veto that particular money. But then you hear, we've been hearing about a gas line since before I was born. So I don't know when we're going to give up or if it's just going to be a perpetual hope. I mean, given
that will put something in perspective for the viewers out there. Tony, will this be the subject of discussion in rural Alaska, or does life go on out there?
I think there'll be some discussion. When you look at the list of contractors that Denali Pipeline employed, 56 some, a number of them do their work in rural Alaska. There's a number of Doyen.
And Alaska important native corporations. Mm-hmm.
Doyen subsidiaries, a number of them, Era Aviation. So they were spending money that affected rural Alaskans directly, and they did have a plan for 6 takeoff points on their pipeline within Alaska. So there was something there, but like we talked about, it's been talked about a lot. So,
But the contractors, that's real because they will no longer be.
There was some real money flowing into rural Alaska, so that's a loss.
Do we just give up on this thing? I don't think we can. I mean, I don't know. You go back further than I do in terms of the pipeline. You got me about 10 years or so, but this is, as far as I know, this is the closest we've come. We've gone further down the path this time than we have had in the past. And unless there's somebody out there who knows where, there's a hidden huge second Prudhoe Bay, I think the Alaska economy really does need this.
And the spokesman for TransCanada would say, we're making steady progress. It may not be always totally visible, but we're pursuing this project and we're going to do it.
Yeah. And the other thing, and this could just be spin, but you know, the governor sent out a statement saying, well, now this frees up BP and ConocoPhillips to join TransCanada and Exxon in a project. It may just be wishful thinking or some spin going on there. But yeah, there's still a ways to go before this thing plays out, I think.
Let's get back to Brendan. Brendan, Jeffrey Dunn's book, The Lies of Sarah Palin, is out. He's certainly not trying to fool us with the title of this book. It is by, we should note, a very reputable New York publisher.
Yes.
Can you tell us about a little bit about Mr. Dunn, what he has to say, and what it adds to the study of Palinology?
Well, I suspect that this will be volume one. That's the feeling I get from Jeff, although he is sick and tired of Sarah Palin. We excerpted part of the book in last week's newspaper, last week's press, and that portion of the book was about the convention, largely about the concession speech at the Biltmore down in Phoenix, Arizona, and her attempt to give her own concession speech against the wishes of John McCain and Steve Schmidt, his advisor. Is there anything new? I'm about halfway through the book, to be quite honest. He goes way back. It's very, very thoroughly researched.
Who is he?
Who is Jeff? He's an investigative reporter and filmmaker out of Santa Cruz. He's also, I believe, teaches in Santa Cruz as well at the university. And he's a frequent Huffington Post contributor. But yeah, I've learned some new things. There's some interesting background of going all the way back to when Sarah Palin was in eighth grade and some of the tiffs that she had with other girls and how her clique was, you know, the fancy girls clique. And it's pretty fascinating stuff.
And is he going to come up here and do a book tour, a book selling tour?
The last time I spoke to him, Alaska was not on the book tour.
And why was this in the Anchorage Press and not, for example, Playboy?
Playboy was an option, as we talked about earlier. Steve Schmidt, John McCain's campaign manager, advisor.
Yes, he ran the campaign.
Yeah, he ran the campaign. Is a primary source for Jeff Dunn's book. Interestingly enough, there are at least as many Republicans as Palin political, you know, foes of Democrats as sources for this book. But Steve Schmidt apparently didn't feel comfortable with his part being excerpted in Playboy. And Jeff Dunn has worked at alternative news weeklies like My Paper for all his career.
And as a practical matter, this will be read all over the world by anybody who wants to read it. It might be just a little harder to read.
Yeah. So Jeff called us and said, you know, I think that this, excuse me, is most appropriate for the Anchorage Press. And I said, thanks.
Let's go read it.
Yeah, that's thanks. Great. Let's crash my website.
Tony, it's whaling season on the North Slope. Some communities are having success, others not. Your newspaper and reporters have written about it. Tell us about it.
Well, like most things in Alaska, it always is about the weather. And this spring, problems, they're having problems in Barrow, the village of Point Lay, 200 people, not so many problems. In the Barrow area, they have this manifestation of ice ridges, which are basically big jumbles of mounds of sea ice, like hills of sea ice. So. It's not unusual to have those, but what's unusual is the amount and the location of a lot of them this year. A spokesman for the executive director of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission said that blamed westerly winds for pushing, building up these jumbles of ice, these pressure ridges. And so in order to get to the sea, to get the whales, you have to chop through these. And some were describing it took a month's worth of chopping in order to get to the sea. So that's why Barrow has four whales right now out of its quota of 22 for the year.
And what's the total quota for northern Alaska, do you know?
Don't know the total quota, but typically at this time of year, Barrow will, that area will have about three-fourths of the way towards their quota of 22. In Point Lay, a little bit simpler for them. They only are allowed to get one whale a year, and they got their whale. It was 50-ton plus bowhead that they got on Friday the 13th. So they're pretty happy with that. And this is the second, their second whale in 74 years. So they, wow. they had gone through a period ending in 1937 where due to people leaving the community, they stopped hunting. And in the 90s, they tried to get that quota back. And it's only been in the last few years that they've been able to do subsistence whale hunting again.
Thank you, Tony. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Steve McDonald, Brendan Joel Kelly, and Tony Hall. Steve, finally, it is over, and it's over when it's over. The Alaska legislature goes home. Can you total up the hits, runs, and errors, and maybe even the men left on base?
You need a calculator?
Yeah, right. Oh, my. Yeah, the men left on base. I didn't think about that part.
Coastal zone management.
Coastal zone management is a man left on base. Yeah, they didn't get to that one. That was a biggie. Didn't get to it. I think they settled their budget differences. The big ruckus, of course, was over the capital budget that the Senate seemed to be holding hostage. It also contained language in it that said if the governor vetoes one of these energy projects, he vetoes them all. So there was a big fight over that. The House was mad because it hadn't gotten a chance to really look at the capital budget and add its projects into it. So all this seemed to kind of just fizzle out altogether at the end. The House got the budget. They it went from about $2.9 billion to $3.1 billion. The Senate, stripped out the language about the energy projects and the vetoes. Senate didn't seem to squawk about that, and they all went home. So now it's going to be up to Governor Parnell. It looks like he's going to get some good use out of that red veto pen.
And I think just about every fair-minded critic or observer would note that none of the branches, the House, the Senate, or the governor, covered themselves with glory in this proceeding.
No, not really at all. There seemed to be a lot of blame for everybody on this. The Senate was doing some things that very questionable when it comes to the Constitution. Can you really bundle projects together and tell the governor if you veto one, you veto them all?
I don't think so. That to the whole budget.
Right. They were telling the Senate you can't really do that. And then the whole process just really didn't go very well at all in this whole thing. Everybody.
Brendan. An interesting dynamic that we have the bipartisan working majority, and this session Republicans had the majority leader. Senator Meyer, and of course the chairs of finance are Republicans. So it was I thought it was really interesting to see the Republican on Republican battle you didn't hear so much from the Democrats in the bipartisan working majority.
No, they let you the know, others
you, do. You didn't see Johnny Ellis going on TV and talking about this. You saw the other guys.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Tony, Walt Monaghan, the former Commissioner of Public Safety, is now about 6 months into his new job, which is President of the Alaska Native Justice Center. Tell us a little bit about the center. Tell us a little bit about Mr. Monaghan. Your staff sat down with him and had an interview, which, among other things, covered once again his time with Sarah Palin, which wasn't so great for him.
No, it wasn't. His position with the center is a pretty natural segue because he had been on the board for the center, which is an advocacy group for Alaska Natives, helping them to work through the justice system. He had been on their board for 10 years, so pretty natural that he would move into that role of leadership in January. Talking with Monaghan about his work there, that's something we'll have in a later installment. We'll highlight that in more detail, but spent an awful lot of time in about an hour and a half interview talking about his relationship with his former boss. You look at the story in a Q&A format. He basically laid out his hiring and firing process and some interesting moments in that. He talks about when he was interviewed by then Governor Palin and was asked what loyalty meant to him, and his response in short was that it's it's based on a set of values, but it, when somebody crosses those values, loyalty demands that you hold them accountable for doing so. And he came into this really saying, well, I really feel good here. I feel comfortable. He goes on to talk about how during his term as Commissioner of Public Safety, he had 4 face-to-face meetings with the governor. Some commissioners had fewer than that, he noted. But when it came time...
If I remember correctly, cabinet meetings were either erratically conducted, erratic in their scheduling. They were infrequent.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He didn't go into that. He did talk about when he was fired. He was out in Bristol Bay observing wildlife troopers, and got this call that said he had to be back in Anchorage the next day at 3 o'clock to talk with Palin's chief of staff. And so his wife met him at the airport, gave him a suit. He heads to the meeting and was offered the position of director of the Alcohol Control Board.
And Beverage Control Board.
Control Board. And he asked why, and said, well, you're basically told him his services were no longer required as of that moment. And said, well, why? And he brought up that trooper, Mike Wooten, who some might remember as Sarah Palin's former in-law, and the chief of staff told him that, well, no, we're just changing direction. So he goes into a lot of other interesting details in the interview as well, but it was basically his hiring and firing.
Trooper Wooten, Alaska's best-known trooper nationally and around the world, right? Brendan, there are 3 competing mandatory ID proposals for alcohol purchase here in Anchorage. At package stores. I suppose it also apply to.
That's what the difference between the 3 is.
Okay, you could tell us about these proposals for mandatory showing
mandatory
of your
ID
and where it's headed.
Well, you know, we voted on that. We voted, and I believe 2/3 of the voters voted yes on should package stores. This language specified package stores on the ballot. Be required to have mandatory ID checks to check for the red stripe, which means you're alcohol restricted. There are 486 people in Anchorage who have a red stripe on their driver's license, and that's supposed to say, you know, you can't sell to that person. And I actually found out this morning, speaking to Assemblyman Hahnemann, that there's a $1,000 reward for an establishment to bust one of those people attempting to buy alcohol at a package store, which that I don't think has really been made public at all. So yeah, there's 3 ordinances. One says package stores, bars, and restaurants all have to do mandatory ID checks. The other says not restaurants that have beer and wine licenses, just bars and package stores. And one is package stores only, and that one was, that's the most recent version, and that language was put in by the mayor and by Assemblyman Trombley, our youngest and newest assembly member. Talking to the assembly members that I interact with, I have a feeling that the package store only one is most likely to pass. The industry is adamantly opposed to this and have been writing.
Well, who is behind it then? We could easily guess the.
Assemblyman Hahnemann, who is a former police officer, former Assemblyman Mike Gutierrez, and Dick Traney on the assembly.
They would say we're responding to the public. The public has voted, and this is what they want.
They've got an excuse now. You know, they can hide behind the advisory vote.
Mm-hmm. But Traney was the one who wanted to broaden the scope of this thing and include the restaurants.
Yes. Yeah. That was the initial. Mm-hmm. That was the first one.
And if I might ask, is there anything to the idea that you would have to buy a drink or have to show this every time you bought a drink or around? Even though they'd looked at it before just 15 minutes previously?
I asked that same question of Assemblyman Hahnemann this morning, and he said no. During a lunch rush at Chilkoot Charlie's, this server would ID the person once and wouldn't have to ID them again if it's the same server and the same customer. And in the evenings, they would have all the drinking establishments would have a door person So there's one person responsible. The server's not responsible. The doorman is responsible for checking all of the IDs. And then once you're clear with him and have made it in there, you don't have to pull your ID out.
Steve, you have anything to add based on your reporting here?
No. Just I think Brian handled
okay.
it.
Okay. Steve, then we'll go on to this topic. Wev Shea, the former U.S. attorney, is suspended from the practice of law
right.
for 25 months. There have been many people who, or there have been some people who knew that this might be in the works, but most of us, this came as quite a surprise,
yeah.
I think.
I think it was last summer that there was a three-person panel, legal panel, that made this recommendation. They found that that Wev Shea had committed conflict of interest by representing the sister of a former client of his, and they felt that was a conflict. And there were some other things that they felt that Wev Shea was out of bounds on as well. So this was the final, you know, decision that they adopted, this recommendation of the 25-month suspension of the legal license, law license. So they also, before he comes back to practice law, he has to have a psychiatric exam.
That was probably the thing that leapt off the page.
Yeah.
Mentally stable.
Yeah.
He has to prove himself mentally stable.
Yeah, that's a big one as well. Yeah. So this is somebody who's had a long, illustrious career here in Anchorage in the legal field. You know, as you mentioned, a U.S. attorney, former U.S. attorney, and he had his own private legal practice. So, Wev Shea is always, you know, he's certainly called the media many times.
Yes.
We're certainly in his Rolodex or his speed dial. You hear he gets involved in a lot of issues around town. He's kind of one of those legal heavyweights in town.
Brendan will attest to this as well. Of on the phone, it's Wev
right.
Shea, and I sort of wondered sometimes he had a blanket over his head to make it even more secure. Mike, there's something really important I got to tell you.
Yeah.
But you went through that many times,
yes,
right?
Yes. Yes.
What's ironic about the whole thing too, though, is that you know he's been brought down here on ethics charges that he violated various ethical regulations in the legal field. And
he and Ethan Berkowitz co-authored the white paper on ethics for Governor Palin,
right.
correct?
Yes. I mean, he's a stickler for ethics.
Yeah.
That's his big issue is ethics. You
mm-hmm.
know, and if somebody was out of line ethically,
he'd
most
call
of
us.
Phone calls, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's
well,
the irony
he says
of
the,
this, I reckon.
You know, the bar and some bar association and the Council on Judicial Conduct was somehow out of line or didn't have all the facts,
mm-hmm.
but they just said time to move on.
Yeah.
Tony, pilot bread now enters the world of art and competitive activities. We had a bake-off involving pilot bread, or I guess the second reference that should be that iconic biscuit. Perhaps you could tell us about this.
Yeah, well, the idea for the recipe contest started with a piece of art, a 8-foot box of pilot bread a la Andy Warhol, made by an Anchorage artist. Shows up in the parking lot at Cook Inlet.
I've seen it. It's fabulous. It's worth looking at.
Yeah.
Yep, and this was the inspiration for, we ought to couple this with the Native Youth Olympics, which has been going on for over 40 years now, iconic in its own right, and have a recipe contest. And about 200 some people sent in their recipes for pilot bread.
200 people?
About 200 and some. Mm. And the former executive chef for Orso Restaurant, Rob Kanin, was the judge. And
a man of great palate. I know Rob.
He even had his own pilot bread story to tell. I think we probably all have a pilot bread story to tell. But Rob was a judge, and he determined that he went for basic, stable recipes that he felt people in rural Alaska would have things on hand to prepare. So the winner was a woman from Aniak, Sue Holt, forgive me, Sue, if I'm butchering your last name, but Sue had a recipe for moose burger. Very simple, eggs, ground up moose meat, some spices, but that's what Kanin said he was looking for, was something simple, something that most people in Alaska would be able to make.
And and the pilot bread is then served with it?
The pilot bread, it's a sandwich.
Oh, that's
ah.
It's a sandwich,
yeah,
yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. The second place winner from Crow Village had a salmon type of salmon spread. The third place winner from Bethel, a 16-year-old girl, had pilot bread sundae. So imagine bananas, whipped cream, and one cherry. So she only got one month supply of pilot bread. Second place, 3 month supply. The winner, 52 boxes of pilot bread to take her through the year.
That's
a lot of pilot.
She says a lot of college survival packs to put together.
She'll need a pilot to fly it out to wherever she is. Where was she again?
She was in Antioch.
Okay, the Antioch village. We're about out of time here on Alaska Edition. We want to thank you for joining us. Thank Steve, Brendan, and Tony for joining us. We will be back next week, and we'll see you right here on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.